Hello, welcome to Stars, Cells, and God. This is the show where we look at new discoveries taking place at the frontiers of science, ones that have theological and philosophical implications, and even new discoveries that point to the reality of God's existence. I'm Jeff Zwerink. I'll be your guide today as we look into some new research topics. But before we get into that discussion, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our channel, Reasons to Believe. Click on that bell icon so you can be informed of new videos. You can go to reasons.org and learn more about us or by following us on social media at RTB_official. Hugh, good to have you here today. I'm going to just throw the ball over into your court and let you tell us what discovery you have to talk about today.
Several discoveries. I mean, this has been an exciting week in terms of what's known as xenotransplantation, transplanting organs from animals into humans.
Okay.
So there's been some marvelous successes this past week. Fuzz has spoken on Star Cells and God about the science of xenotransplantation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to talk about some of the recent successes and what it implies about the way God has designed the animal kingdom. But we are facing a crisis. I mean, we've all known that, it's relatively straightforward to take a kidney from a living donor and to put it into a human, because we all have two kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're healthy, you can get by with one kidney, so you can donate it. But the truth is, a lot of the kidneys for transplants come from people that die in an accident, and they're able to keep the body alive even though the brain is dead and harvest the organs.
So it leads to a supply problem. So there's probably a far greater issue with people needing than what we have to donate. So,
a dark joke is there are just not enough people riding motorcycles without helmets to supply the necessary organs.
Yeah, that is a little dark there.
And the statistic is that there are 90,000 people in the United States waiting for an organ transplant.
That's a large number, 90,000.
And 3,000 die every year waiting for an organ.
Okay.
So the wait list is long. I mean, we've got an employee that's been waiting 3 years for an organ transplant.
Right.
Fortunately, she's able to function, but there's a limit to how long that she can last. So, I mean, it's hitting us personally.
Yeah.
And most people know of someone who's waiting for an organ transplant.
Mm-hmm.
The list is long. And so there are just not enough human donors available, even though there's been an aggressive push. As you know, when you get a driver's license, they want you to indicate that you're prepared to donate your organs if something happens to you.
Right.
So, and these days, they can even take a piece of your liver and put that into another human who's got liver failure, because you don't need your entire liver to function.
Interesting.
So they've been very aggressive at trying to raise up the number of human donors to fill the demand, but it's nowhere close to what's needed.
Right.
And worldwide, there's millions of people waiting for an organ, and literally over 100,000 die every year waiting for an organ that's simply not available. And so this is the promise of xenotransplantation. If we can find some safe way to take organs from animals and transplant them into humans, where they survive just as well as a human organ, this would really solve the problem.
So that's got to be a hard thing, though, because I know with organ transplantation, even if you go from a human to a human, I couldn't donate an organ to anybody just because there's blood type issues, there's rejection issues. I mean, we have to work pretty hard even to get that work human to human. I can't imagine, I've got to imagine that animal to human has even larger obstacles or hurdles to overcome.
Very much so. And this is what Fuzz has spoken about on previous Star Cells and God, is that, geneticists use CRISPR-Cas9.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll basically say, take a pig, and they'll use CRISPR-Cas9 basically to transform their liver or their kidney or their heart. They genetically modify the pig in such a way that it simulates a human organ.
Okay.
And so all the genetic issues that would cause the human to reject a pig organ, they overcome with CRISPR-Cas9.
That's actually kind of a cool way to do that, because, you know, at some level, I know how you do that is you reduce the immune system of the human, so it's not attacking so much, whereas this is not kind of crippling the human's immune system at some level. It's changing the organ so that the immune system isn't going to attack it in the first place. That seems to be a lot better.
Well, this is an issue you have with human donors, is that they talk about getting a donor that's a perfect match.
Right.
But they mean by a perfect match, it's so close to your genetic type that you don't have to sweat the rejection issues.
Right.
So the patient doesn't have to take as many anti-rejection drugs.
Right.
Which have, you know, side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal is to reduce the need for anti-rejection drugs.
Right.
By using CRISPR-Cas9 to make the organ as genetically close to what's going to work for the human that's going to receive the organ. But as Fuzz has pointed out, a far more challenging issue are viral attacks.
Hmm.
In other words, when you pull an organ from a pig and put it into a human, you're bringing viruses.
Right.
And so you need to find some way to enable the human receptor to be able to deal with those potential viral attacks. And it's not that you're just bringing viruses in but via the organ. You're basically, because the organ is going to be exposed to human viruses that the pig isn't being exposed.
Right, yeah.
But there are,
well, and some of, I mean, yeah, you know, just to kind of emphasize that, I was just thinking, you know, you got bird flu, you got swine flu, you got, all of those are viruses that were in animals that are now in humans, and they cause, those tend to cause a lot of problems.
Well, this is again where CRISPR-Cas9 comes to the rescue, because you can genetically modify the pig organ so that you're not going to be overwhelmed by viral attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So actually putting into the genetics the viral defense mechanisms that are necessary. But this is a lot of CRISPR-Cas9 genetic modifications.
Right.
But even back in 2022, they were able to take a heart from a pig and put it into a human. And the human, and basically the government is saying, you can only do this where there's no other option. Because, you know,
this is kind of pretty experimental, I would imagine.
So, what happened, there was a man that was going to imminently die from heart failure. And so they said, okay, we'll allow doctors to do an experiment.
Right.
So they took a heart from a pig and put it into this man who was facing imminent death. And it extended his life by 2 months.
Nice. So, okay.
That was good. But, I mean, it's expensive.
Yes.
Just for 2 months of life extension. But basically showed the promise of what CRISPR-Cas9 can do. So they said, let's see if we can get a little more aggressive with that. And on March 10th of this year, there was a group of Chinese surgeons in China at Zijing Hospital that were able to take a liver from a pig and to put in. In fact, this next slide actually shows you the liver that they took from the pig.
Okay.
So, now, liver is a big organ.
It is a good size organ.
And so they were able to take this and put it into a human. Now, what they did is they put it into a human who was brain dead.
Okay.
So it's like, the guy's already dead.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to see, okay, let's put a liver into this man.
Okay.
And see how long the liver can function. And so they made an agreement ahead of time. We're only going to let it run 10 days.
Okay.
And so after 10 days, they monitored the liver throughout the 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
It performed perfectly.
Okay.
So it was actually excreting the bile and doing it at a rate that was totally normal. And then they removed the liver after 10 days and noted that they saw no degradation in the liver at all.
Okay.
So, and with this, they did three CRISPR Cas9 genetic modifications. So even with only three, they were able to say, hey, at least with the liver, it was able to function perfectly for 10 days.
Okay.
Which gives us the promise, hey, maybe with a little more CRISPR-Cas9, we could do a lot better. Okay. And then March 16th, just a few days ago, an American team at Massachusetts General Hospital, they were able to take a pig kidney and put it into a human that was suffering from severe renal failure. Mm-hmm. So it's like he was at a point where dialysis wasn't going to help him any longer.
Okay.
But he's 62 years of age. He could live a lot longer. So they said, let's actually do what we think is everything possible. They did 69 CRISPR-Cas9 modifications. Three of them focused to make sure that the organ wouldn't be immediately rejected.
Okay.
All the others were based on dealing with the potential for viral attacks. So I said, hey, we really want this individual to have a long life after that. We got to really be aggressive at dealing with the the potential for viral damage.
So just to clarify, you said, you know, let's do everything possible. And I realize that's a little bit of a fuzzy term. Is that like, this is the stuff we know of that's a problem, so let's do everything? Or is that this is as much as we can do before we start degrading the function of the liver? Or what determines the boundaries of what they're doing, I guess I'm asking?
They said, let's go with what we know is going to be a problem.
Okay.
It's possible that there could be additional CRISPR-Cas9s that could potentially even eliminate the need for anti-rejection drugs. But they said, these are the three we know are going to help. Mm-hmm. And then also with viruses, there's a lot we know that could be a potential threat.
So the aggressive is we're going to do, rather than be conservative, we're going to go after everything and try to do as well as we could possibly do.
Everything that we know.
Fair point. Yeah. Right.
Let's do the best we can to try to keep this individual healthy and strong.
Right.
And so, but it holds the record for the most genetic modifications. The total is 69.
Okay, that's quite a few.
Nothing even close to that's ever been done before. Mm-hmm. And so, the fellow who got the transplant, he's doing well. I think he's already been released to go home.
So this is on the order of a month. No, that's like 10 days. Yeah, you said March 16th today. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it's only been 10 days.
Okay.
So, and when they made the announcement, they said, we think we can let him go home tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
Which was 7 days ago. So
okay.
Probably home.
Right.
So
he's recovering well then.
He's doing very well. And the organ is functioning really well. Mm-hmm. So everybody is quite confident that this could be good. And one reason why they are confident is they did experiments previously with monkeys, mm-hmm. where they took pig organs and put them into macaque monkeys, and they were able to, the organ was functioning well even after 2 years.
Nice.
So it's like, it looks like we got the potential to give this man at least another 2 years of life and maybe much longer. Mm-hmm. So because... and so they're just wanting to...
Because that's, I presume that that's different than when you go human transplantation. Presumably you get a little bit longer longevity, I would guess, because every 2 years is really hard.
Well, 2 years for a macaque monkey is probably equivalent to much longer for a human.
Okay, fair point.
Because, you know, macaque monkeys don't live as long as we do.
Right.
So, you know, they were doing genetic modifications for the monkey. This is genetic modifications for the human. Mm-hmm. So it's a different set of modifications, but it's the same technique.
And yeah, also, no, I was just thinking, you know, you can say, all right, you know, of the 90,000 people who need liver transplant or transplants, you know, if they have to keep coming back every 2 years, you kind of haven't, you've extended things and made it better, but you haven't quite solved the problem there. But that's not really the issue here. It's not 2 years as a limit. That's just what we know at this point.
We're even facing that with human organs. In other words, if you get a kidney from another human being, there's a limited lifetime for that kidney. Mm-hmm. So it's not uncommon. We've got an employee that's on his third kidney.
Right.
So it's like, it doesn't, on the other hand, with human kidneys, you're looking at 10, 15, sometimes 20 years.
Right.
And so what they're looking at is, say, could we get that kind of longevity using organs from pigs? So we could get it up to, say, 10, 15, 20 years. That would really resolve the problem.
Right.
Because now we could mass produce these pigs and actually, instead of having millions of people waiting for organ transplants, they could be scheduled.
Oh, yeah. No, it makes sense. I was just thinking.
A lot of lives. lives.
At some level, if it's 2 years, the recovery time from the surgery is on order, you know, similar in time scale to the. But yeah, you know, we're talking significant improvement here. Yeah,
doing this or hoping that they're going to get a lot more than 2 years.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
It's like, you know, even 2 years is a remarkable achievement. Mm-hmm. If it is 2 years, that's still something that's worth pursuing.
Right.
So, but your goal is, hey, let's get it a lot longer.
Right.
And the ultimate goal is, hey, could we actually make it better than what we got with humans? Because basically, if you need an organ transplant, they would do a genetic mock-up on you, and then they would go to the pig, mm-hmm. Do all the CRISPR-9 things. So you would actually have an ideal match instead of something that's just close that you get, say, from a typical human donor. So that's the potential that maybe this could even be better, mm-hmm. getting an organ from a human. And what they're doing in this case is they're raising pygmy pigs. So they're trying to get pigs that are the approximate body weight of a human.
Yeah.
I've got friends. You've
got to have similar sized organs is what you need.
Right, yeah. Because if you're raising pigs for meat, the pig probably comes in at 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, a little larger than most people.
So organs are going to be a bit bigger. And it's not impossible to put them in a human, but you really begin to crowd your...
Right. No, that makes sense, yeah.
You want the organ to be approximately the same size. So it's like, let's go with a smaller mm-hmm. species or a pig species that's close to the human. And then the other advantage is they could harvest the organs from young pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, I'm too old to give you a kidney if you want.
Right.
after a certain age, they say, you know what? Your kidney's already suffered a lot from thermodynamics.
Yep. No, that makes sense.
So
right.
And typically when you're getting an organ from a human donor, it's not somebody who's a teenager or in their early 20s. It's somebody that's older. And so it's like, okay, with the pigs, we can harvest the organs at the ideal time for the human donor. And so, what amazes me just looking at this as a Christian, isn't it interesting that God designed pigs and a whole other animals in such a way that they're optimized for human medical advance?
Or that they're even close. I mean, there's no reason they need to be that close, but yet they are. It's remarkable.
For decades, scientists have been doing research on rats and mice because their digestive tracts are a good analogy for the human digestive tract. A lot smaller, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, notice they eat the same kinds of foods we eat. And, you know, their digestive tract is optimized for an omnivorous diet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they actually have the same kind of, you know, bacterial support system that we have. And so for decades, scientists have been doing research on rats and mice to help make medical advances to deal with our intestinal issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with, you know, mice and rats have a brain chemistry similar to ours.
Right.
So we've been able to do research on mice and rats to deal with human brain diseases and brain malfunctions. So same thing with certain birds. Birds have a brain structure that's similar to ours. So it's like...
It's kind of amazing the diversity of animals that are so different from us, but yet... function similar to us is really kind of cool.
It's like it seems like our creator built in common designs into these different higher animals so that we humans could use these higher animals to further human health.
Yeah, because experimenting on the humans to do that is a little problematic.
Yeah.
Just to be really sarcastic there. It's more than a little problematic.
But the fact that God designed pigs in such a way that it's actually possible to harvest our organs and put them into humans to extend human lifespan and functionality is quite amazing in itself.
I am curious. You know, I do find it very remarkable, and I don't particularly have trouble with this question, but I'm going to ask this question because, you know, if you hear what the idea here is, we're going to raise pigs or whatever animal it is so that we can harvest the organs to help humans. And I don't think anybody would disagree with the help humans part. But there is kind of this growing movement, or at least a very vocal movement out there. It's like animals are people too kind of movement. That's the way I would characterize it. It's, they're equating animals as almost having equal value to humans. And so on what basis do we get to come in and say, hey, a pig can be sacrificed to support a human? Why do we get to do that?
Well, you're raising an interesting biblical principle that God created three different kinds of life. Life that's purely physical, life that's physical and soulish, and one species only here on earth that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. And the Bible commands us to put a much higher value on the latter, on humans.
Right.
We alone are created in the image of God. We alone have a spirit. And so we're to put a higher value in humans than we do in animals. But there's another principle in here. We're to put a higher value on those life forms that are physical and soulish. That would include all the birds and mammals. And so, and we're commanded in the Bible, we're to treat our animals well, treat them with kindness. Now, in the case of these pigs that they're raising for organs to be transplanted to humans, I mean, it's to our advantage to raise these animals in a stress-free environment. Because the more
stress, to care for them well, effectively,
I mean, if they're well cared for, that's going to improve the quality of their organs.
Right.
And so, I mean, if they're really stressed out, I mean,
that causes physiological damage. That makes sense.
You might not get as good an organ as you want. And so, treating them well with kindness, making sure that they're stress, relatively stress free. And I also notice, because I got relatives who are farmers, is that if you treat your animals, your farm animals, as your pets, they seem to do a whole lot better. And they actually raise a higher quality of meat, higher quality of offspring. If you actually communicate with them soulishly. I mean, there was one of our donors who was raising ostriches. For ostrich farms. And he says the key with ostriches, they like human contact. And so it's important that they get human contact. You can't treat them like cows where you can throw them on an open field and they're fine.
Right.
The relationship you have with them is important. I suspect the same thing is going to be true of these pigs, that giving them lots of human contact and showering them with human kindness and making sure that they live in a stress-free environment, is going to improve the quality of their organs. And hey, we're talking about harvesting these organs from young pigs. Well, it's also the ideal time to harvest the meat.
Right.
And so it's like when you're harvesting the organs, I mean, the animal is going to be dead. So it's like you can sell the meat.
Right.
And so economically,
it's not wasteful.
It's not
wasteful. No,
right.
That's good.
And so that's going to be good quality meat that you can market.
Well, and I think there's an aspect of Christianity that I didn't appreciate until I was having a conversation. I think we were talking about personhood and the human value. And one of our visiting or our scholar community members, Joe Miller, made a statement. He goes, what's interesting is in Christianity, as you described, there are spiritual animals, humans. There's only one of those, and there's value because of being a person. And then there's also in the Bible, there are these other animals, and they are important. So you can't just as humans say, well, we can do whatever we want with them. No, there's value. God puts a value on them because of their relational, social nature that they have. You know, the way that God has created them, they have value. But the interesting point he said is that very often, many worldviews outside of Christianity, there's no way to put value on something other. And so you see this kind of increasing push to make animals more like humans. And, I probably may get in a little trouble for saying this, but you look at just the language you use. We talk about having our fur babies and our dogs and cats. We talk about them as almost people. And so I think that's we need to be careful there, because I think we blur the distinction. We don't want to blur the distinction between humans and animals. We want to value them, but we need to keep the distinction because there's value for these animals in their ability to serve humans, which if they become humans, we're missing. So,
Yes, and I think we all know people who put a higher value on their pets than they do, say, their grandkids.
Sometimes, yeah, it's sad. So,
well, I think there's an explanation for that biblically. The grandkids are sinners, their pets are not. And so
that's a fair point. Yeah, animals don't willingly rebel in the way people do. So,
and moreover, you know, they will bond to you in a way. I mean, a dog will run to you every time you
go through the door. Mm-hmm.
Your son's not going to do that,
but your dog will.
No, your son will. It takes a while. It's just different there. I mean,
well, it's like a dog in their 20s, maybe.
But I mean, you know, it is a lot of work to raise children that have those sorts of values, maturity like you're looking for there, whereas animals kind of naturally have that unless you beat it out of them. So,
because they're not sinful.
Right, exactly. So,
and we need to recognize, hey, we are to put a higher value on humans than we do, quote, our pets.
Right.
Because they're sinners. They need to be redeemed. We don't have to worry about the animals.
Right.
They're going to be around. Now, one other thing, if I could look at the next slide here, basically shows you the amount of work that they had to go, not just in, you know, taking care of all the CRISPR-Cas9, mm-hmm. but the surgery itself. So this basically shows you the kidney is being pulled from the pig. But I think this is interesting.
It looks like a surgery room.
It's a surgery room. But it was a 4-hour surgery.
Oh, so this is actually the surgery tube. This is not taking it out of the pig. This is actually to install it in there. Okay.
Surgery.
All right.
So again, from Massachusetts General. So you can see a lot of labor went into this.
Right.
A lot of technology. Look at all the technology. Mm-hmm. Look at all the labor. And people will say, well, it's just too expensive. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once this kind of xenotransplantation reaches a success point,
right,
where they're not just going to be doing this, some people are going to die in a few days anyway, where it now becomes available to people that would normally have to wait for a human transplant. I anticipate that this amount of labor and technology will eventually develop to a point where you're not going to have to invest this much labor or this much technology into it. Once you start scaling up to millions of operations, they're going to find ways to make this more efficient.
Absolutely, yeah.
Surgery will go faster. And so, because that's right now a concern. This is just so expensive to do. But hey, when you're doing the first few xenotransplantations, mm-hmm. it is going to be expensive, but that expense will drop, both in terms of money and labor.
Right.
Once this becomes more routine. In fact, I even anticipate there could come a time when these kinds of surgeries will be done robotically, in which case there could be an enormous saving in both time and money.
Yeah,
so that shouldn't be a concern, is that, you know, let's let this research go and say if this individual received a kidney transplant, if he's able to survive 10 years with a good quality of life during those 10 years, then I think we've got a winner here.
Well,
something that really scaled up.
Well, and it's an interesting phenomenon. Or, you know, I would also comment in there. It's like there needs to be an environment. This sort of stuff wouldn't happen were there not resources to invest in risky, financially risky, and even somewhat physically risky. Because, you know, I mean, you know, some people could. It might not go well. I mean, there's a. There needs to be a level of we're willing to take risks to advance, and there needs to be a level of resources to invest. Hey, we may invest a lot of resources and find it not work, and if you don't have an environment that allows for that kind of entrepreneurship or that's not the right word for it, but kind of what could be, you know, if it becomes too much where we're counting all the pennies and all the dimes too carefully, we don't allow for this kind of research, which means you know, you just wouldn't have the kind of advancement so that people could live longer by xenotransplantation.
Well, another rationale
for pursuing this technology is we've got a falling birth rate. And so to maintain our economy, we got to find some way to keep people productive for a longer period of time. So, for example, you've got people.
I think it would be better to encourage people to have families than to keep people alive longer for that. I think that's but I get what you're saying. Yeah, there is value in keeping people alive longer.
And keeping them productive,
yeah.
That's going to boost the economy. Whereas if you just let them die, mm-hmm. they're no longer productive for the economy. So even for just purely economic reasons, this is a good thing to pursue.
I think that's a great way to say that. If you're just looking at economics, it's worth. I know you have far more value on people than that, but that could sound very utilitarian, and I know that's not your position.
Sometimes we need that utilitarian motive to actually maintain this kind of research. And
That's fair, just as long as it doesn't ever become just utilitarian. So.
Well, I mean, if I had a relative that needed, an organ transplant, that was not, I would want to do everything possible to try to give them more productive years.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So.
Yeah, okay.
Very good. I'm going to shift a little bit of gears here quite a bit in terms of instead of talking about human organs, we're going to actually now go out onto a bigger scale and look at some of the largest structures in the universe. And, I was actually just having a conversation with somebody the other day. We were talking about how large the universe is. And, we know that the universe is 14 billion years old, but the physical scale of the universe in terms of how far out could, or the, what is the furthest distance of an object that we could see, it's actually about 45 billion, 46 billion light years away. In today's time frame, yes. And so what's interesting, though, is that there was a discovery reported or a research paper presented at the American Astronomical Society in January 2024 of what was a giant arc that was discovered a couple years earlier, but now there was this big ring on the sky. And I love the creative astronomer names, giant arc, big ring on the sky. We need to go to a creativity class for naming. But
it's better than a license plate number, which is actually much more common.
All right, I'll give you that. Suffice it to say the name, but this is a large cluster of galaxies, the big ring on the sky that is about 1.3 billion light years across, and it now falls into a class of objects or class of groupings that we found. There's about 10 of them, which are larger than 1.2 billion light years across. And why that's important is that if you go and you say, all right, we know that our universe is made of cold, dark matter, and there's a cosmological constant, and it's expanding, and we know the parameters of the universe and how it's behaving. You can now ask the question, given the way the universe develops, what's the largest structure we should see in the universe? And there's a fundamental idea that governs how we think about that. It's called the cosmological principle. And ultimately, I don't know whether it dates to Isaac Newton, but it flows out of, or it's an idea that has produced an incredible amount of scientific advancement, because it basically says what we see here on Earth is the same as what's going on out in the cosmos. So Newton saw that and said, ooh, things fall to the Earth because of gravity. That also explains why your moon orbits around the Earth and the Earth orbits around the sun. It's all gravity. And so now I can use this equation to describe how things behave on Earth, and I can use that to describe what's going on out in the heavens.
Right.
And so there is a little bit of an extension to that. It's not just that the laws of physics are the same, but when you look at things on large enough scales, it doesn't matter what direction you look, everything's the same. So that direction isn't better than that direction, or it's not going to be different on average. And no matter what scale you look at, on large enough scales, everything looks the same. So it's isotropic and homogeneous and the same laws of physics. So those, to me, seem to be the essential principles or the essential components of this cosmological principle. And so when you apply that and you say, all right, we know that the universe began in this inflationary epoch. It cooled down, it eventually started to cool down. You had stars, nucleosynthesis going on. You had quantum fluctuations that were amplified during inflation. And we can explain the cosmic microwave background and all this sort of stuff. Now we can ask the question, if the cosmological principle applies and things grow by these original fluctuations, density fluctuations into larger structures, what are the largest structures that could form on average there? And that's where this 1.2 billion light years arises, is doing those sorts of calculations. And so now you've got this really weird question of, if 1.2 billion light years is the largest structures that could form, how is it that we're seeing structures that are 1.3, 3.3 billion light years, maybe even 10 billion light years across? And it just reminded me, that this is these sorts of things happen all the time where it's like, okay, we have our model, we make a prediction of this is what it should be, and then we find that as we go observe stars with the Hipparco satellite, we find stars that are older than the universe. Or we find galaxies like with the James Webb that are too big and complex for the early part. In the early universe, the galaxies are too big and too large. And so we find these things and it looks like it says, oh, our model must be wrong. And I think what I see in there is kind of two kinds of behavior that there are people who want to be critical of the current science, and they say, see, science is just wrong. It's got stars that are older than universe. It's got galaxies that are too complex. It's got structures that are too large. Therefore, we can't trust what the science is out there. But I think what people miss is that these sorts of discoveries actually just highlight it. It doesn't say, ooh, we're all wrong. It says, though we've got the big picture correct, there are details in here that we want to investigate. And I know that with the stars that were older than the age of the universe, people went in and said, okay, we've got these measurements that say these stars are 13, 14, 15 billion years old. Our calculations say the universe ought to be this. And so they go in and say, all right, have we missed something? Might we be wrong over here? And they go do the calculations about the stars and say, all right, are we missing something? Let's put more details in there. We don't just take the simple assumptions, add more details. And every time they've done that, these things that shouldn't happen inevitably disappear, or at least they become dramatically diminished. I think there are still a couple of stars that we measure by our measurements seem to be older than the age of the universe, but what used to be thousands is now a handful.
And there are stars with error bars of plus or minus a billion years.
Exactly. And so
it doesn't really contradict because
right, exactly.
accommodates the age of the universe.
Well, and it's almost because we have these new discoveries or these things that are weird or, oh, that can't be, that's what prompts us to go in and look in and dig into those details deeper and get a more thorough picture of the universe. And I kind of flip that around and say, you know, I'm as a Christian, and people are always challenging the Bible in there, you know, and saying Christianity and saying, well, this can't be. And so they'll come and they'll point out, well, the Bible says this here and this here, so how can it be? In fact, I think I remember asking you one of those questions where I'm going to say Samuel, and I'm drawing a blank on which books it was, but where David took a census of the people, and that was a problematic. And in one place it says Satan induced David to number the people, and the other one said, and God caused David to number the people. And it's like, well, you got these contradictory things. How can that be? If the Bible's the inerrant word of God, how can you have contradictions in it? And, you know, your response was along the lines of, you know, there's so much that validates that Scripture is true. So how would we resolve that? Well, it's like if you realize that God is sovereign over everything, including Satan, this isn't a problem here. And it's like, oh, so by looking, getting a bigger picture, a more complete picture with more details in there, instead of the simplest model, what appeared to be a contradiction actually just fit very well. And so I see that same sort of principle applying here. And I think that, you know, I thought a couple of things that I wanted to emphasize is, one, it's entirely possible that these things aren't actually structures that are that large. You know, I know you remember, and maybe our audience remembers, that there was the Viking 1, when it was flying to Mars, took this picture, and it looks like there's this large structure that's a human face or a face of some sort. You know, it had things that looked like eyes, a nose, mouth to it, had roughly the same proportions of a human head. And so there was this face on Mars. That was back in 1976. Well, I mean, you look at it and it said, yeah, it looks like a face. It looks like there's something there. Well, we've now sent more sensitive instruments that can high resolution instruments. Yeah. You know, you go to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and you can, it has 10 times better resolution. And you look at it and it's like, no, that's not a face there. It's just a bunch of rocks, accumulation of stuff. Yeah. So the fact that with the lower resolution, all you're seeing were the most extreme contrast, the darkest and the lightest, it made you kind of interpolated and said, oh, there looked like there was a face there. That once you had, you could see all of it, it went away.
It only looked like a face at the right sun angle.
No, that's fair.
It didn't.
No, exactly. That's true. And that doesn't help illustrate my point. Is that when we're out looking at these galaxy clusters, we're looking at the brightest of those, not all of them. Right. And one of, you can actually go show that if you generate a completely random set of clusters, you know, things that are brighter and dimmer, and then you apply this same sort of analysis where you just look at the brightest ones, you see those sorts of structures arise out of them. And so you know it's random because you generated it. But when you apply these sort of analysis that find these large structures, you'll find structures in this randomly generated grouping of things. And so we need to be careful and just recognize these may not actually be structures that really exist. They could be artifacts of our measurements.
We know just to have life in the universe has to be uniform and homogeneous at a particular number. If it's totally homogeneous and uniform,
right,
no life is possible. But if it's not approximately uniform mm-hmm. and homogeneous, life is also impossible. So just the fact that we have astronomers running around at the American Association conference tells us, hey, it's got to be within certain bounds.
Well, and in fact, I was talking about that homogeneity, that applies on distances larger than about 250 million light years.
Right.
So obviously there's a sun. That's not homogeneous with the universe, but when you get out onto a large enough scale, now it becomes homogeneous.
We need it to be non-homogeneous and non-uniform on small scales.
Right.
And homogeneous and uniform on large scales. And we got a pretty good idea what range we need mm-hmm. in order to have life in the universe. So when we see something that's outside of that bounds, we know we've made a misinterpretation. Because like, hey, we're here. And so we're a constraint
right.
on the homogeneity and uniformity.
And not only that, the fact that we found something like that, I think that's often a clue that there's something interesting and fascinating going on there.
Well,
so finding these large structures is saying there's something fascinating going on here that we need to investigate more.
Back from my graduate school days at the University of Toronto, every June we had this June Institute where we would invite four of the world's leading astrophysicists mm-hmm. to come, and each would give a week-long course.
Right.
Well, I remember one cosmologist came and he spoke about the fact that we're finding within our galaxy and other galaxies stars that are oriented along perfect circles.
Okay.
So basically, you see several dozen stars and they look like they're forming a circle. He did a statistical analysis showing how perfectly they fit that circular arrangement.
Right.
And he came up with this idea. You know, there would have to be a supernova eruption at the center of that circle that explains why we get all these stars forming
okay.
along a perfect circle. And then people were saying, yeah, but supernova tend to be rather chaotic in their explosions. And they're exploding their material where there's already stuff, interstellar clouds in the area. Why would you get these perfect circles? And his response was, well, but look how many I've found.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them at just the right sizes we'd expect.
Right.
If indeed we have these supernova eruptions. A couple of years went by, and an astronomer published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal just saying, these circles are strictly statistical artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
He basically did a computer simulation. You know, put 100 million stars out there and randomly distribute them. You're going to get perfect.
Right.
Well, I think we're seeing the same thing with galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there's trillions of galaxies, well, 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. There's enough galaxies that I think we statistically have the same possibility that we're going to see apparent large structures
mm-hmm.
which are not real.
Now, especially when you're seeing the brighter ones of those and stuff. You know, so some of that is you just have to see more of them.
That's
and
a
the,
good analogy, because
what happened with this claim that we're seeing these perfect circles, mm-hmm. they said, let's do a really deep image of that area.
Okay.
And they found several faint stars that didn't fit along
right,
the
okay.
circle.
Yeah.
Your point is true. If all you're seeing is the brighter stuff or the medium stuff and not the full sample
right,
stars,
yeah.
you could get the wrong impression. And so we're looking at the distant universe and they found this gigantic mm-hmm. perfect circle of galaxies at a fairly good distance. It's like, well, a follow-up study would be, let's look at that with very long exposures, and let's see what the small galaxies tell us.
Right.
So the small dim galaxies don't fit the structure of the big bright galaxies. We know this is a statistical artifact.
Right.
Now, at this point, we don't know.
Exactly, yeah.
And I appreciated the astronomers just saying, there's a lot we don't know about this big circle of galaxies we found.
Right.
And this is some additional research we need to do to see if we're really seeing something physical that's causing this gigantic circle, or is this just a statistical artifact?
Well, no, that's actually been true in gamma ray astronomy as well as, part of the early part of very high energy gamma ray astronomy, which I did as my graduate and shortly after, there were lots of statistical tests. You know, you wanted 3 sigma was generally, that's a pretty strong statistical signal there. And so we were finding a lot of these periodic signals. And it ultimately ended up being that we recognize, there's all these detections that ended up not being detections with more sensitive instruments. Right. And what we realized is like, okay, there's just more here we need to worry about, and you got to worry about sample size. So without kind of having some of the excitement of the finds, there wasn't the additional research that showed, hey, here's actually what's going on. And ultimately, we did start finding these sources of very high energy gamma rays, and now there's hundreds of them. Over the last, I guess that was 1992 was when I was first starting to look at that. So over the last 30 years, there's been a huge increase in the number of very high energy gamma ray sources simply because we kept investigating to figure out what was going on. And that's what I expect would be going on here. Yeah. I don't know what the resolution. It may be that they're real and they're signs of cosmic strings, or they're real and they're signs that conformal cyclical cosmology is the correct way of looking at it. Or it could be that they just don't exist. They're an artifact of our measuring techniques. But without doing the research, we're not going to see. And the bigger apologetic picture in this is that it's easy to look and say, oh, here's this problem. We don't have to worry about it. I think there's been some history of people in the church. We've done that in the church where we've kind of looked skeptically at science. And so, well, here's this thing I don't understand, so I can throw it away. And I think there are some skeptics who do that looking at Christianity. They find something that says, okay, there's something here. And instead of investigating deeper, they just summarily reject it. That's the wrong way. But the reason why we can even ask these questions is because of the incredible regularity and understandability of the universe, that we're looking at very detailed questions compared to the questions cosmologists were asking 20, 30 years ago when I first got into science. These are questions we couldn't even begin to ask because the technology just wasn't there. So now we're digging in deep into the details, or much deeper into the details, and just say, to be able to do that requires a universe that is homogeneous on the large scales, that is isotropic, that the laws of physics here are the same as the laws of physics out there, that orderly and predictable and regular, and that our mind can grasp it. That's exactly the kind of universe the Bible describes. And it's not clear to me that any other worldview gives you that kind of universe, or it says that that's the way the universe ought to be.
Well, it also demonstrates the Bible's predictive power. It got the cosmology right thousands of years ago.
So I think that's a phenomenal thing. And so let's not miss that. These are fascinating things. And I think you said it. I know I've seen it. That when these problems come up, scientists don't go say, let's just throw everything away. It's like, oh, cool, new problem to solve. Let's go investigate and figure out what's going on.
Right.
Which is exactly the sort of thing that I think God wants us to be doing with his special revelation as well. That it's like we're reading along, and it's like, oh, I never caught that. What does that mean? How can I dig in deeper? That's just what we're doing when we're doing science here.
I mean, you brought up the example of the senses of David. And, atheists like to bring the point, hey, this census is described in two parts of the Bible, and the numbers are different,
right?
Quite different. But if you read the details, in one sense, all the tribes are counted. In the other census, two tribes were not counted.
Right.
So of course, you're going to get different numbers. But if you don't spot that detail, you're going to think, hey, there's a contradiction here.
Yeah.
Likewise, there's details in
exactly
that we could be overlooking. But we know we're here. So it's like, okay, the homogeneity and uniformity has got to be within a certain range. Let's dig in. And I think a lot of lay people are getting impatient with the James Webb Space Telescope. Astronomers knew all along it's going to take a good 20 years to really dig out what's happening in the universe. And the James Webb can't do it all by itself.
Right.
It's like, wait for the extensive observations that we need to do to really solve these problems. Let's dig in and see galaxies, not just the bright galaxies.
So patience is a problem. Who'd thunk that? So
I think that's in the Bible.
Somewhere. I don't know. But, well, I appreciate the discussion today, Hugh. And I want to thank you for joining us today on Star Cells and God. Encourage you to join the discussion in the comments below. Remember to like this video, to subscribe for more content. New episodes of Star Cells and God release each Wednesday. They're available here on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app. Remember to share this video with a friend. Have a great discussion about it. And remember, the more we know about science, the more reasons we have to believe.